I'm just going to set it down here then. Anyway. Baptismal regeneration, the idea that you can be saved as part of baptism. The second thing that they got messed up on baptism, well, they argued about it. It was a huge argument for many years. It's going to make you laugh. Whether you need to dip them once or three times. And the truth is the Unitarians dipped them once and the Trinitarians dipped them three times. So this was a big argument, huge. And it went down party lines on whether you're an Arian or whether you're a Trinitarian. The third one was whether you baptize babies or not. Because another doctrine that came very clear in the third and fourth centuries was the doctrine of original sin. And it's very clearly taught in the Bible. And so, you know, the idea with these babies, you know, what happens if my baby dies? And so the answer was, well, let's baptize them from the time they're born. And they have the circumcision as a explanation of how it does it, what have you. And so they started baptizing babies. But you'd be surprised. And the Catholic Church will say they were baptizing babies even from the time of the Bible. They'll use Acts chapter 16 where he says, thou shalt be saved, thou and thy house. And it says he went and baptized him and his whole family. And so they said, well, we assume there was babies there. Okay, that's their best shot. But the truth is, if you read the histories, you'll find, and they've got plenty of proofs. The Baptists have done their revisionist history. They have searched them out. They are zealous for this thing. They go in there and they find the histories, the proofs, that these babies were not baptized. In fact, they have arguments. I think it was Jerome and Augustine. They have arguments from them that show that, no, they did not baptize their babies. Babies started getting baptized in Africa, around the 3rd or 4th century. They've got some evidence that they started being baptized around then. But most always it was adults even then. In fact, the way we know that babies were being baptized is because the Bishop of Africa wrote a note saying, you're not supposed to be baptizing babies. So we know they were baptizing babies, but the bishop said, you're not supposed to be doing it. So you can see what I'm talking about. It's obvious they did not baptize babies very much. It got worse and worse until by probably... they started baptizing babies pretty significantly, probably around the establishment of the papacy in the time of Pope Gregory, 600, 650, something of that nature. And it became more and more. There were still outlying places that did not do it. But I'll tell you something else. They dipped the babies. They didn't sprinkle them. It was a dipping procedure. They would dip the baby in the water. And that's the fourth one.
Today, can I have a question? Today, yeah. When the Catholic Church, when they sprinkle, do the families believe they're saved at that point?
They believe they're safe.
Safe?
They wouldn't say saved. Catholics don't really believe in saved anyway.
Oh.
They don't have the same idea of saved that we do. If you ask a Catholic if he's saved, he might actually say, yes, I am. But that's because they have learned how to answer us. It's not because they believe in saved like we do. They believe you won't know you're saved until after the judgment. But yeah, they believe they're safe. For the longest time, they believed in limbo. But seriously, in the last 10 years, they've done away with limbo. So now this new pope
purgatory.
Says there's no limbo. Now, well, yeah, they still have purgatory. But I'm thinking that's next to go. They're changing things in the Catholic Church. Who knows what? But they have now disowned limbo. They say it's not true. But they used to believe that a baby that's baptized would go to limbo, but that's neither here nor there. That's just part of that mess up. The fourth part of baptism was whether it's immersion or aspersion or sprinkling. And the truth is, as late as 1600, we have proof that Catholics were immersing, dipping. I mean, they were not sprinkling. The normal mode of baptism was dipping, not sprinkling. And that's the sacramentalism. The second side of the sacramentalism is the Eucharist, and that is they believed that the Mass was the true sacrifice of Christ again, and that is tied up with the priestcraft that comes later. The fifth is idolatries. And we read this about the Pergamos and the Thyatira, that these idolatries came in. On the Greek side, it was a masculine idolatry. It was use of images. They did not really worship Virgin Mary. They did call her the Theodocus or something like that, which means the God bearer. So she had some special place, but it was not anything like the Western side. The Latin side, they got so deep into idolatry. In fact, it started at least as early as Tertullian. He's my favorite old church father to read because he's just as sarcastic as they come, and he wrote a book on idolatry, and he just deals with Christians who have mixed up idolatries. He was real hard against the Christians that celebrated Christmas. I'm not trying to just, you know, bring it up and knock you over the head with it, but the truth is he hit it right on the nail. He said, you Christians, you call yourself Christian, and yet you're celebrating Saturnalia, Brevissima, the Brumalia. You're celebrating all of these feasts, and all those now what we call Christmas. You're doing it, you're decorating the evergreens, you're giving out gifts, the New Year's gifts and all that, you're doing all that stuff, and you call yourselves Christians, and just nails it all the way down the line. He could not stand how idolatry had just gotten so mixed in. And of course, what else is going to happen? It's just what happens. It just assimilates. And people have customs, and they just keep on with their customs. If you like to read somebody who really has a way of doing it, of course, it depends on your translator. Tertullian. The Catholic Church rejected him as a heretic because he became a Montanist. The Montanists were very strict legal. He was very upset that the Catholic Church was accepting lapsed. In other words, back in those days they had the persecutions, and the persecutions, what they finally started doing is they would kill these people if they did not renounce their Christianity. And the way they would make them renounce their Christianity is they would make them swear allegiance to one of the gods. And that's the way they would do it. Well, they got to the point then that there were so many Christians that they could not go and do a personal thing on everybody. So if a Christian did not want to die, they could just buy a certificate saying that they had sworn. And so a whole bunch of Christians had bought certificates that say they had sworn allegiance to these gods, which gave them the power to buy and sell and, you know, live normally and everything be okay in the midst of these persecutions. Well, when the persecutions stopped, the Christians that did not buy these certificates that suffered, some of them died, you know, they didn't want to take back in these Christians that, you know, that had bought these certificates. They were called lapsed Christians, and Tertullian was against the bringing back in of those that are lapsed. He thought that was a very good way of purging out the church, you know. And of course the others say, well, no way, they were real Christians. They just, you know, didn't want to die, you know, so they were very practical, you know, they did their thing. And they didn't really swear allegiance to these gods. They just bought their certificate saying they did, you know. So it's a big argument. Who knows who was right? Tertullian says no, and so he went and joined the Montanists. The Montanists turned out to be later on, oh, they accused him of something, I forget, heretics. So then Tertullian is now considered by the Catholic Church a heretic.
How do you spell your name, dear?
Tertullian. Okay, idolatries. This is when they started the relics. A guy named Vigilantius. The only way we know about this guy, because remember the Catholics that had so much power, this was the Catholic Church, and I say Catholic with a small c because there was no Roman Catholic Church in those days. It was the Catholic Party. Above all the parties, there was the Catholic Party. There was the Arian Party. There was the Catholic Party, which were Trinitarians. They are the ones that pushed through the Nicene Creed. So there's the Catholic Party. You had Vigilantius. Now, Jerome was part of the Catholic Party, and the only way we know about Vigilantius is because Jerome wrote a scathing denunciation of Vigilantius. The name of that work is Contra Vigilantius. And he quotes Vigilantius many times in there. And in there, Vigilantius is really raking the Catholics over the coals because of their veneration of relics. Now, relics were pieces of the cross. They were bones of the saint that had been burned. And these things are supposed to be doing miracles. So he really cut them on these false miracles that they're proclaiming that they're doing. And this is Vigilantius. And of course, they burned all his works. He was condemned as a heretic, and all his works were burned, and you couldn't buy them, you couldn't use whatever. So we don't have the actual original works, but we still have what Jerome wrote about him. And the truth is, the guy was a good guy. What Jerome wrote about him He was a good guy. This guy was preaching just like we would have preached, and he would have said, you can't do these things. These things are wrong. So they were using relics, and they had shrines. They had built shrines. So between Tertullian, Vigilantius, and a bunch of others, they had this big fight, this big argument back in those days over the idolatries that had come in to the church. The sixth one I have is dominion. That's the usurpation of political power. That is where, listen, Catholicism and Christianity grew by such tremendous growth that all of a sudden they are the most powerful players in the political world. I mean, they have a block of voters, even though they didn't vote, but you know, you vote with your feet, you vote with your screens, you vote with your purchasing power. Everybody has an influence. And so when you have, you know, 40% of the entire empire claim to be Christians, this is a huge chunk of the economy. It's a huge chunk of everything. So they begin to have tremendous political power. Well, these bishops that were ahead of the groups in their city, they had political power. They started wielding it. They started using it. And what happens when you do that, basically you marry church and state. Church and state become one. The bishop has the power. He starts running things. They start having armies at their disposal. And I'm telling you, that's the beginning of the papacy. We could say that it began with Constantine, but the truth is Constantine, he did the Edict of Milan, which is a tremendous document. In fact, I copied it, and I'll read a portion of it in a minute. But it's a tremendous document for religious liberty, tremendous step forward that got tossed out after a while. But he was never a pope. He was never a pope. In fact, he went Arian for a while. He wasn't even a Trinitarian for a while. So, and then the fellow that came after him, Theodosius, he did the Edict of another edict. But this was the edict that forced Christianity became the official religion. That happened toward the end of the fourth century, 370, 380, something like that. This edict made Christianity the official religion. So everybody had to be Christian. Up to that time, Christianity was just the most powerful player among everybody. But when he made that edict, everybody became Christian overnight. They went out and baptized them by line. But
what is exactly that definition of an edict? Is that a
edict?
Law?
It's a declaration. An edict is a declaration of law. The Pope would put out an edict. The Edict of Milan, I don't know if I even got it in here written down somewhere, but it's the Edict of Milan and then the Edict of... Oh, come on, I know I wrote it down somewhere. I don't have it. I've got it somewhere, but my notes are really in bad shape. I know, I had it on the timeline. Here it is, right here. Hold on. It's called the Edict of Thessalonica. It made it the original, the official religion.
Where is that on the timeline?
That's 380. That's the year 380.
Constantine.
He did the Edict of Milan. That's the Edict of Toleration. That's where he said Christians have a right to worship the God however they choose. And that edict was for every religion. Everybody can worship God however they choose. The Edict of Thessalonica undid that and made Christianity the only religion allowed. So they had religious liberty for 67 years. All right. Now, I don't remember where I was going with that.
Dominion, political power.
Oh yeah, that was the beginning of the papacy. The papacy did not even start then. The Bishop of Rome was not accepted as the leader of all Christianity, even with Theodosius or with the Edict of Thessalonica. It didn't really come in play. Now we have certain ones, like Cyprian was a strong supporter of the Bishop of Rome. He called it the primacy of Rome. Rome was the premier place. And they had all their arguments back, that's in the year 300. They had all their arguments in favor of the primacy of Rome. But all the other bishoprics did not believe that. They didn't just follow Rome because it said that. But Gregory, which is like in the year 660 or whatever, changed the calendar. He was so powerful and did so many. And by that time, the Empire of Rome had fallen. There was no Empire of Rome. The Gregory had taken over all of that. And so he should be considered the first pope. So the papacy had completely taken over the power. Gregory is the one who sent Augustine of Canterbury all the way to the British Isles to bring them into line with the pope. And the British Isles refused. The Saxons accepted it, but the British refused it. That's why they had what they called for many years, they had what was called the Celtic Rite. The Celtic Rite was a Christian church in Britain that had been there since the times of the apostles and had lasted, and they had sent St. Patrick over to Ireland and had completely converted Ireland by that time. None of these were aligned with Rome. This was not part of the Roman church. And that's why you'll get these revisionist historians that'll say, well, see, those people were, you know, Baptists. Those were Baptists over there in Ireland. They were Seventh-day Adventists or whatever, you know. And that's just as dishonest as the Catholics saying, you know, they were Catholics. It's hard to figure out where it's going on, but people are lying about the histories. If they just read the Bible, they realize all of this confusion was intended. It was part of what God had predicted. It was going to happen. And so, yeah, you've got good and bad in every single one of these groups. And that's what Jesus says in Revelation 2 and 3. He says, I know thy works. I have somewhat against thee. You have this problem, you have that problem. None of these were perfect groups. None of these were perfect traditions. The seventh one is priestcraft. After the papacy, primacy of Rome, episcopacy, which is I called Nicolaitanism. Also, priestcraft comes under the head of Nicolaitanism. Priestcraft starts off with celibacy, the vow of you cannot have, and that happened early on. Some groups just insisted they could not be married. But the truth is, there were married priests and married popes and married bishops and married all the way hundreds of years. Probably didn't become universal until about the year 1000. That's the celibacy. Now, I don't have a clock. I don't know how long I've gone, how glazed over your eyes are. But this is...
We have 3.23 minutes left.
No,
we're not going by that, but you asked.
Oh, it's been an hour? Okay, well, I'm gonna wrap it up with a couple of things in here.
That last one was priestcraft?
Priestcraft. That's where you get celibacy, you get confession to a priest, you get excommunication, you get masses for the dead, you get purgatory and limbo, indulgences, rosaries, all of that stuff came in early on, talking about the year 300 on. It started becoming more and more and more and more, till by the year 1200, by the time of St. Thomas Aquinas, it was pretty much universal in the Western Church, all of these things. Except for the dissident groups, and there was a bunch of dissident groups. I have a timeline here. Let me just rattle off the ones that I think are important. If you go onto Google and type in church history timeline, you'll get hundreds of them. And their timelines are almost useless. Because all they do is talk about, you know, this council, that this statement, this pope, this whatever. It means nothing. I'm going to give you my timeline. It's very simple. Not very many things. The timeline of important events in church history. The Jewish War. The loss of Jerusalem in 70, the year 70. That's a very important timeline. That's when the temple fell and the Jewish rite ceased. The Second Jewish War, in the time of Hadrian, it ended in the year 135. It was between the year 132 and 135. That's when Jews were kicked out of Palestine and they ceased to be an active part in the church. All the Jews that were Christians were assimilated into Christianity. They became separate things. The Jews and Christians became separate groups. The Edict of Milan in 313, very important event. The Edict of Thessalonica in 380.
Can we copy that?
Yeah,
but
well, just listen, and you'll get the idea of what I'm going with, and then you can copy it, and I'll make a list of it, and put it on a deal, and y'all can just download it or whatever. After that, and there's probably something important to say about Gregory, and even Leo the Great in the 400s, he did some big things for the Catholic Church. But I'm not even putting those in. I'm putting in the events that have to do with people like us. Churches that were not part of the power scheme. We were just being persecuted by every different group.
Edict of Milan and Edict of Thessalonica.
Thessalonica, that was in 380. 610, the conversion of Muhammad. Muhammad changed. He no longer, neither pagan, neither Christian, nothing like that. He had his own religion. This is a huge event in church history. Yes, it is. It's still there. All right, 664, the English church joins Rome. That was the Synod of Whitby. That's when the church that followed St. Patrick and Columba, the Scottish church and all those, the Celtic Rite, joined Rome. They were forced to. The year 732 was the Battle of Tours. The Mohammedans had just gone all the way almost to China, and then they'd come all this way, taken over all of North Africa. They had crossed the Bering Strait, not the Bering Strait, the Strait of Gibraltar, and got onto the Iberian Peninsula, that's Spain and Portugal, and conquered all of Spain, and had attacked and completely conquered almost all of France. And they were going to take over all of Europe. There was no army except one, and that was the army of Charles Martel. He was one of the nobles in France, and he gathered his army and went and fought Ibrahim, or whatever his name was, Al-Rahman, and the caliphate that was taking over everything, had way outnumbered him, whatever, and he beat him. He beat him in Tours. That was in the year 732, and that was the end. That was the farthest extent of the Muslim empire. They were driven back, and eventually by the 1400s, they were driven out of Spain.
That was called the Battle of what?
Tours, T-O-U-R-S, in France.
That too, Brother Brian.
Yeah, just let it go. Who cares?
No relationship to the Tour de France, huh?
I honestly do not know. That might be. I have no idea. The Tour is different. Okay. Anyway, 739, 7 years later, another battle happened. It's called the Battle of Akroinon over there in what's modern-day Turkey. And that's where the Greek side of the church was also fighting these Muslims, and they won a tremendous battle that stopped them for 1,000 years. That was in 739. 1054, that was the division of the East and the West. That's when the Greek and the Latins broke, and they finally said, we are no longer part of the same. And so that broke, and it hurt the power of both of them. That the Muslims started up again. In 1099, like 50 years later, or less than that, the fall of Jerusalem to the Saracens. Jerusalem fell, and it was in power of the Muslims till 1967. That was 1099, the fall of Jerusalem to the Muslims. 1330, John Wycliffe. The Protestants, the Puritans in the Reformation time, insisted that Wycliffe was a holdover from the Celtic Rite. That, in other words, the British church had stayed hidden in Britain, and it's very possible. I don't know that. But they're thinking that Wycliffe came from that. So another theory is that Wycliffe came from the Lollards, and all of his followers were called Lollards after that. Lollards were Anabaptists that came from Germany when they were kicked out of Germany. Anabaptists being one of those groups of people that rebaptized Catholics when they got saved.
And what does the date on that?
That was in 1330. That's when he started preaching, 1330.
Well, what's the problem with baptizing a Catholic after he gets saved?
You get burned at the stake if you do that.
Oh.
That was the problem. they did not like that at all. They thought you were crazy. What you're saying is your baptism is not baptism. In fact, they rejected the name Anabaptist. They said, we don't rebaptize anybody. If you've been baptized, we leave you alone. But being sprinkled as a baby, or even dipped as a baby, you're not baptized.
Right.
So anyway, okay. 1450, the fall of Constantinople. Remember, the Muslims, as soon as the East and West divided, the Muslims started again. They started pushing again. They went up into Spain again, and they went into Turkey, and they took over all of Turkey, and they fought. Constantinople is right up right there at the end of Turkey, and they fought, and they finally took over Constantinople in 1450. And in 1453, a printing press was invented in Germany. Huge, huge issue. Made Germany the most powerful place in the world for about 75 years. 1492, balance of power went to the Atlantic seaboard. They discovered America. And what happened was all the power that had been in Rome and in the Austrian nations and Germanic peoples and had been in Armenia, had been in all that power that was there just became nothing because Spain, Portugal, France, England, and even the Dutch to a certain extent, they had their navies on the Atlantic seaboard. When they discovered the Americas, all that land was theirs. It was theirs. They just went over there and took it over. And they had all that gold coming in. The power just completely shifted. All those inner city, all in Russia, all those places that used to be the powerhouses, they were all of a sudden nothing. They had nothing. And all the power went to France, Spain, and England, and Portugal. That was a huge thing. 1517, the 95 Theses. That was the beginning of the Protestant Reformation. 1644, Oliver Cromwell, the Puritan revolt. The Puritans took over and killed the king. Huge thing. And that's also 1644. They call it the interregnum, the between kings. That was when the Puritans had such political power. By the time this happened, the English Reformation had happened so powerfully in the 1500s all the way up into the early 1600s that the Puritans had so much power, they forced the accepting of a parliament, an elected body of people to contrast with the king. Finally, the parliament had their own army. They fought the king's army, defeated the king. The king then committed treason by trying to recross the English Channel. He was exiled. He tried to recross the English Channel and fight him again. They convicted him of treason and killed him. And that was a huge no-no. They killed the king, and that made all of the houses of Europe, they all had kings. they weren't allowed to just, you know, accept that. They lasted for like 20 years, and a lot of problems. When Oliver Cromwell died, the parliament just fell apart, and the son of Charles that was killed took back over and pulled Cromwell's bones out and burned them and did a whole bunch of other things. This said, we're not putting up with that anymore. But believe it or not, this Puritan revolt was the first experiment in self-government by a Christian styled democracy, the modern democracy. And those Puritans that had to flee for their lives, they went to America, and that's exactly why we exist as we do. That the Puritan revolt got shifted to the Americas because they weren't so persecuted over here. So New England, that's how that happened. Let me see. I say 1644. 1917, the British retake Jerusalem at the First World War. It's a tremendous story that the British decided to attack over there in North Africa, and instead of going to where they should have gone, they went over and took over from the Ottoman Empire, which had joined the Germans. They took over all the promised land and governed it. And that same year, they declared the Palestine to be a national homeland for Jews. And Jews just flooded the place. They came over and flooded the place. Started up the new nation of Israel. 1948, Israel becomes a nation, is recognized by the United Nations, and in 1967, Israel takes Jerusalem. The British took over Jerusalem and then gave it to the Palestinians when they said, we can't handle this. It was a three-way war. The British and the Arabs and the Jews were all fighting over there. And the British said, we wash our hands of it in 1948. They left. Huge war! And Jerusalem was left divided. But in 1967, Israel took over Jerusalem completely. So that's the timeline. Now, you read these revisionist histories. Read them and you'll find what they're going to talk about. People like us. See if I can just rattle them off to you. People like us. The Baptists call it the Trail of Blood. They've actually got books about that. Huge. Seventh-day Adventists, huge. You can find so much information by the Seventh-day Adventists and the Unitarians, including modern-day Jehovah's Witnesses. They've got their huge, you know, their own revisionist histories explaining who all these people are. The first ones that we know about are followers of Montanus. They're Montanus. They are Montanists. That was about the year 156. Tertullian became a Montanist. Strict morality, rejected the lapse. They rebaptized. They rebaptized lapse to get them saved again. They would only baptize adults. They believed in the Trinity. They were Presbyterian. They were anti-Episcopal. They did not believe in central power. They lasted until about 722. They were in contact with the Paulicians later on. Novatius, the Novatians, about the year 250. They were later called Cathari, which is Latin for Puritans. They believed in a pure church. They were anti-Episcopal, and they were also rebaptizers. The Donatists started around 311. Anti-bishops, they rejected the political power of Rome. They were also rebaptizers. They rejected infant baptism. They believed in immersion. They believed in freedom of conscience, no force. And that's where vigilantes comes in. These vigilantians, especially up in the north of Italy, very much against relics. They were not in favor of vigils for martyrs. They did not accept vows of poverty or celibacy. They're people like us. They might have had some bad doctrines. I would not doubt it at all. God might think we have some bad doctrines, you know, if we look back at it from a purer standpoint. But these were people like us. They were existing. They were in. They had their own groups. They had their own. They were preachers. Paulicians from about 660 on. They lasted till 1100s easily. They were forced to leave the Greek side by a lady named Theodora. She was the wife of the emperor that when he died, the emperor was an iconoclast. You got to understand, the Greek side had a very big division over images. And they had the ones that were very much against images, and you had ones that were very much for images. They had wars over whether the church was allowed to have images in worship. When the emperor finally died in about the year 800, might have been 840 or something, I don't remember. When he finally died, his wife became emperor instead of his son by her power, and she was a very strong pro-images, and she made an edict that made images the official doctrine and persecuted the Paulicians and all the other iconoclasts, the ones that broke the images, the Protestant type people, and persecuted them and forced them all to leave the whole land of the Eastern Orthodox side. And they all moved to France, became what's called the Albigenses later, or the Cathari over there, and who knows, they called Bogomils, Paterines, Bulgarians, because they came from Bulgaria, the good men, let's see, Petrobusians, Henricians, Arnoldists, Berengarians, Lombards, Picardists, Waldenses, Lillianists, or the poor of Lyons, the Vaudois, which are the Waldenses. They're all called Anabaptists because they rebaptized. They were called Catabaptists because they insisted on immersion. Catabaptists, completely under. And they were called Sebaptists, which was self-baptizers. Because one of them baptized himself. He didn't have anybody to baptize him, but he realized he hadn't been baptized, so he just went out and baptized himself. So they were derisively called Sebaptists, which is Latin for self-baptists. A guy named Walter Lollard went to England in 1315 by persecution. They think he's the one who talked to Wycliffe. That's what they think. John Huss came from Wycliffe, went over there to Bavaria, started the Hussites, 1300s, at least way past into the Reformation. Lasted a long time. Then, of course, you have Erasmus and Savonarola were part of the Latin Church, but were reformers. They were so much against all the corruptions in the Catholic Church. And then, of course, Tyndale. Tyndale was actually a dipper. He baptized by dipping. He believed the Bible, baptized by dipping. But he did that to children. So, but he did not believe in it. I don't know. We're good. There's a whole lot more. That's church history from our perspective. Any questions?
Wow.
So when you're talking about the remnant, are we considered the remnant then?
Yes.
That came down through all this?
These are not just one group. That's the problem I have with the Baptists and their pseudo-history, because they insist that these were all Baptists. They had the same doctrines that we have. And that's just nonsense. These people had strange doctrines themselves. They all had errors. And even Jesus says in Revelations 2 and 3, all of you people have something against you. I have something against all of you. He had problems with them. They were heretics in some ways themselves. So the idea that Baptists are saying there was a pure line of sound doctrine all the way through, no. But there were these arguments all the way through. The Catholic Church is wrong too, thinking that they had, that this is a pure thing that, and that all these people were just heretics. No, these were good Christians. They were believers. They had every much a right to be called Christians as the Catholics did. So your question is, was this pure line up? Yeah, we are the remnant. They were the remnant. There's a remnant. We can't tell who is. That's the thing that Jesus says. You can't root them up because you can't tell. You'll root up the wrong people. We look at it and we see what God sees, a hidden remnant within a much bigger bunch of trash. And this is what God intended. Now that it's all come clean, especially with the Church of Philadelphia, what happened in the English Isles, where actually we won our liberty to actually study what we wanted to do. Religious liberty has just opened the door, and that came from the English Baptists. They were the Brownists or the Separatists. They were not Puritans. They were English anti. They believed in religious liberty. And they started the colony over there in Rhode Island after they were kicked out. In Rhode Island, they were the first place that established religious liberty. Rhode Island back in 1640 or whatever.
The ones that you see pictures of back in, you know, like Thanksgiving, and they're wearing...
No, that's the Plymouth colony. Those are the Puritans.
Oh.
The Baptists, the English Baptists settled in Rhode Island. A guy named Rogers and those people. That's where religious liberty comes from. Democracy comes from the Puritans. That's in Massachusetts and Connecticut. That's where they're the ones who came from the Puritans, the parliamentary forces that were forced to leave, lost all their titles and their land.
They corrupted the system, like these ones are when we went to Virginia and went to Jamestown last year, I think, they were telling us that, and you know, they have a school. Rebuilt the old church and stuff. They said it was against, at a certain time, it was against the law not to go to church.
Oh, yeah.
I never heard that.
In fact, they were as legal. The Puritans were very legalistic. Very legalistic.
Weren't they also the witch hunters?
I don't believe Jamestown were Puritans. I believe Jamestown were Anglicans. They were in Virginia. Remember, all of these states were founded by different people, the different groups. Maryland were Catholics.
I just mean from the first church. Well, but I don't know if they said Kennedy. Pilgrims or what they called them. They
landed several times there. They landed the first time, and they came back there, and there wasn't anybody there. They were gone. They were just, they don't know what happened to them.
They don't know what happened to them. They assume they were massacred.
Yeah, all off.
They found that one first colony that they put there, they found it on an island. It's on an island over there in Virginia somewhere. They found it on an island and they're trying to go back and reconstruct it or whatever.
Well, you'd love
an island in the river.
You'd love going to Jamestown because you could sit there and feast all day long. I mean, they got all this
information. Yep.
We didn't have time. We got through part of it, and there was a big thunderstorm coming.
In my library, I probably got 50 books written in the day, back in those days, written by these people.
The original books?
Original books. Well, I say my library. It's my Google library.
Google.
I find them. I find these books.
Speaking of library,
you're not. I've got a bunch of books in my home, too, went back before Google. I was collecting books a long time. I used to spend $1,000 a year just on used books. And that was when I had no money. I was a missionary. I had no money, and he had a right to be upset at me because I'm.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Well, we're facing on that now. We're still recording.
But Google Books is the greatest thing that's happened since, you know, the printing press. I'm telling you. I'm reading a thing and it says he got this information from this book. Oh! So I go on Google Books, look it up, and there it is, a full preview. I can read the whole thing. Sit there and read the whole thing, and I put it in my library, and I read it.
You read the whole book online?
You read the whole
book. It's free on Google, just because.
It's an amazing thing. Now, a modern book, you can't. They give you a few pages. But all of the older books in the 1800s, any book.
Because they're not in print anymore, probably.
They weren't copyrighted. They weren't copyrighted, or the copyright's done. It's over. They can't keep it going.
Anything copyrighted, they can sell it to you.
But all of those the books that I'm interested in, very few books, modern books, I'm not interested in them. I just can't read them. But I got books from the 1500s in my library that I've read that are just fascinating to me. And not only can you just read them in their pages, they've taken pictures of the page, so you can just read the book. But they've also OCR'd it, so you can search. Like you can search in it, and it'll find exact words and what you're looking for. And,
wow. Well, that took a lot of input.
Yeah.
Somebody did.
I'm about to send my entire library to Google because they do it free. If I send my I'll just pack it up in a box, send it to Google, they'll take pictures of every single one of those books and send me the books back, and then that becomes my property on Google Books.
Really?
And then I can give it out to y'all if I want, or...
Do they send your books back?
They send them back. Well, you can say you don't want them, but they will send them back.
Well, that helps them too if they don't have them.
Yeah, they don't need them. And they've got machines. I don't know if you've seen these machines. They set that book in there. The book never gets completely open. It opens just like that. And they got a camera. Bang, bang. Takes the picture. And pop, moves the page. Bang, bang. Takes
the
picture.
What's the color?
I've seen their fingers doing it. Sometimes you get a picture, and you'll see their finger on it. But they just turn the page and click, turn the page, click, turn the page, click, and then follow along.
I couldn't stand a job like that.
Is the quality
all day?
It's good. It's easy to read. You can expand it, make it as big as you want.
Limited abilities,
and you can search it.
There's faxing in that sometimes.
Just go on and look, and you'll see what I'm talking about. It's quality pictures of the original page, and the older books that they have to clean up. They're pure white on black, and they've cleaned them up so that they're readable. Remember how to get your older books, they use different typesets and they're harder to read. You gotta get used to reading those kind of books.
Oh, yeah.
But you can read them in text. In other words, you can just highlight the text and copy it, put it in a document, and it'll read it in modern text.
Oh, convert.
Because those OCR things, they can convert those old English type fonts.
If it's the real hard to read old English, does it change it into a more modern?
Now you are dreaming.
Okay.
Now you are fantasizing. I want it in sixth grade 2012 English. But that would be something, wouldn't it? I want this book, but I want it in English that I can understand. I'm just amazed at what they do. Google, I know there are a bunch of liberals over there, but no, I love them. I think they're great.
I've heard they've got people that come to work, guys that come to work, and by the end of the day, they're women.
What?
They do what?
What are you talking about?
Well, they're transvestite. You know, they're, like you said,
they're weirder.
They're very weird, very left-wing, you know.
I don't know how they're making money. They're worth billions of dollars, and everything I do with them is free. I don't...
Advertising.
I don't pay anything. It's all advertisement.
Advertisement.
Yeah.
And that's like, I can get a lot of free apps, but they're full of advertisement. If you want the one that's advertisement free, you pay 99 cents or $1.99 or whatever, and then you get your list. That's where they're making money, too.
Well, I cannot believe. For the longest time, I would put, like, I used to get on Advanced Book Exchange, where you go, you're a member of that, and you go onto there, and you put in a request for a book. And, of course, these are used bookstores all over the world that will, if you got a request for a book, and you put it on your request for your price or whatever, and then they would let you know, we have this book. And so you order it from them, and that's how I would get my books, because I'd put my price and what I wanted and what book I wanted. And, but now, I just go on to Google, and there it is. Sure. You're talking about thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of books. Almost every title you're interested in. You go, you find a book that you're interested in, say, you want the The Boston Historical Journal, number 24, that has this article by Samuel College. Type it in. There it is. Read the article.
Wow.
I'm just floored sometimes. Once in a while, I can't find it. Once in a while, they don't have it.
Imagine how many people Google has put out of work.
I don't think they've put anybody out of work.
They shut down the one they were spending. You were able to get the book. Now they don't need them.
Newer technology.
Well, I think they're still going. I still use them. If it's something I don't find on Google, or if Google has it, but it's not complete, then I'll go online and find it. And
you tell them how much you want to pay for that specific book.
When you put a want in. Like, for example, I wanted The Great Inspiration by Charles Webster. And they were $90 to $100 and $120. Every time I'd find one, they were $120 and $90. And I was poor, and I couldn't spend that kind of money on it. So I put in a want that I want one for less than $30. And about a year and a half later, bang, came up there. Somebody was selling one for $30. I got right on there, bought it, got it. I got it.
Really?
$30.
Wow.
That's my most expensive book.
Where do you find the time to read all these books?
Yeah.
When you're all remodeling the house and doing this and doing that, and
working
welding, and, you
when
know, making anchors, and
the
you
truth
know,
is,
preparing for your lesson.
I've been working at this job for 3 years. And this job has me on call, and I'm in my office on call, and I have a computer connected to the internet, and I can read 7 hours a day.
How many 5-hour drinks do you take to stay awake when you're doing all of that?
I don't drink or eat or anything. I've got candy all over my... I don't have candy. I've got candy. All the girls come into my office to get the candy, you know, because I got the candy there and all that stuff.
Sugar high.
And I don't touch it. I don't even eat the candy.
You don't even eat it?
I don't even eat it. I don't drink. I just sit there and read.
You're a fast reader too, aren't you?
I get very bored real quick. It's got to be an interesting read. And of course, what's interesting to me would drive Debbie crazy.
You talk about that glaze.
Yeah, the glaze.
Yeah, a long time. I was that way a long time ago in the study.
Man. I'm just happier than a witch in a broom factory.
Which brings me back. Were the Puritans the ones with the witchcraft that we always hear about?
Yeah, you know, Salem.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Puritans in New England.
They
were really afraid of witches.
On like a seesaw thing and put them in the water, and if they put them down and they didn't drown, then they were okay. Y'all read all that kind
hey,
of stuff.
Don't believe everything you read.
Well, I read the same word that the way they used to test people and persecute them and all that back when those...
Like I say, every one of these groups had serious errors.
Oh, yeah.
With the idea of these Baptists trying to purge their memory and say they didn't have this, they didn't have that... It's just crazy. It's nonsense. And none of them called themselves Baptists, okay? Just let y'all know that. None of them called themselves Baptists. They hated the fact that other people called them Baptists. So the idea that they're finding their pure line and all that, trail of blood and all that stuff.
So the fact that, when Protestant Luther, which is considered one of the first with the Protestants, right?
Yes.
We're not really from them.
Nope. They come out of Catholicism, and they were very Catholic. In fact, Martin Luther didn't want to quit Catholicism. He believed in the Pope and all that stuff. He was kicked out. But these dissenters would have been called Anabaptists, and Luther persecuted them. Luther actually persecuted Anabaptists, the rebaptizers.
And he also baptized babies, right?
Oh, yeah, he baptized babies, so did Calvin. And John Knox persecuted the Anabaptists.
Hmm.
So when you say Luther persecuted, how do you define that? What did he do?
No, they went and burned their homes. They had an actual war. 30,000 peasants in the Peasants' War got killed, and that was over Anabaptists.
And Luther had that kind of power to have that done?
Yes, he had that power.
Wow.
He did it. Now, Lutherans will, you know, revise their history to make it, you know, not... But
clean it up.
I'm telling you, he did it.
And the Lutherans came from Luther?
In fact, Luther thought that when he had found the truth of the gospel, that he was going to explain that to the Jews, and that it was going to convert the Jews. And so he did that. He had a campaign to convert the Jews by showing them the true gospel. He figured the Jews just they didn't believe this corrupt gospel, so he gave them the true gospel. And when they rejected him, he persecuted the Jews. He wrote some serious things against the Jews, and Hitler used Luther's books to justify himself. But Luther was a great guy. So, see what I'm saying? You got people who God really used, and yet they're full of all kinds of junk. So when you see Jesus says, I know your works, I know your patience, but I have something against you.
So how would you describe, you know, that people were so fervent back then, or raw back then, or so close to the beginning of things, were just so cold and lax? Is it just because of time passing, or more knowledge?
You mean that they were fervent and that we are lax?
Yeah,
it
has changed so much because, you know, when a person first gets saved and they're different than they are a few years later. I mean, I kind of understand that, but
as the church as a whole, I would not say that this century has a lax church, because you have to include churches like China. We're talking about 70 to 100 million Christians in China that are willing to give their lives for the gospel. We're talking about the church in Korea is probably the most revived church anywhere.
But the people that are getting saved are not going out and, warring against anybody and persecuting people?
Well, no, because they have learned the principles. These are evangelical Christians that are happening over in China and Korea, and they have a very strong doctrine of religious tolerance.
Yeah, because you gain more biblical knowledge and stuff, and you have more.
Believe it or not, we have gained. I mean, the church history has. The evangelical church, the true church, has more power now than it ever has had. Ever.
I wish they'd come out of the woodwork on November the 12th.
Well, when I say they have more power than they ever had, I'm discounting probably 80% of evangelical Christians. I'm talking about serious. Listen, just a 5-minute conversation with the average evangelical Christian and you realize, I'm not sure he's even saved.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. I was listening to that on the radio earlier, going to work or whatever. The new evangelical Christian, the new evangelical, and it's all the compromise, being politically correct and all that kind of stuff.
Well, mega churches. Yeah. Mega churches is exactly. A tremendous amount of compromise. We are just not going to talk about this, that, or the other thing.
And that's the world affecting us, right?
Of course it is. And you know, they have outward success, and so a church like ours that's not going to compromise, we start feeling bad. You know, we start, well, what can we do? We can start changing the things. Maybe we get a screen in there and have the Bible that we're reading in the back of it, you know, and have a worship leader that has a band and stuff. We can do some stuff, and it wouldn't be terrible, right? But then we're going down the same road that everybody else is going down.
It's not a virgin.
A less successful person.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I was talking
to a bunch of pathetic losers trying to catch up is what we are.
I was talking to this one lady, a girl of ours, Sharon, and we got off on to Jesus, and man, you know, it's pretty good. And I thought, wow.